Thanks, Boris. It's true, I got interested in biology a few years ago, so I'm going to tell you about some of the things I've been working on for the last few years, and as advertised, I'm affiliated both with the Department of Applied Physics and Applied Mathematics, and also an interdisciplinary center, the Center for Computational Biology and Bioinformatics. So as Boris said, I started getting interested in biology, specifically in various topics under the name of systems biology. So it would be useful for me to start the talk saying what I think systems biology is and what I'll be talking about. And the two things that I'll be talking about are a single approach that's applicable to two different problems in systems biology, specifically about biological networks. One is, how do you go about inferring a network from lots and lots of data? A network in this case meaning some sort of model of many different things interacting with each other, where very few things interact and most things don't interact with each other at all. And then the second half will be trying to use a very similar statistical approach to try to analyze the network, meaning somebody's handed you a large network and then you ask the question, so what? And I'll try to make that a little more clear as the talk goes on. In illustrating what systems biology means to me, I'll say a little bit about why is this hard, how the sort of mathematical tools that I'll be using will compare to mathematical tools that we all know and love from physics. The inference problem is sometimes called reverse engineering because you are handed with many, many data from many things interacting with each other, and you are asked to try to infer which elements of the system are interacting with each other and which ones are not. And I'll be borrowing approach from high-dimensional statistics, which is sometimes called machine learning. In terms of the analysis of networks, meaning, as I said, somebody hands you a large network and you ask the question, so what? The so what I'll be asking is, can you tell how that network was created just based on this large edge list, this large hairball that somebody's handed you, some big picture of a network? And I'll be saying a little bit about how some successful, I think, tools from statistics can be applied to questions that are being raised in what might be called network science. So if somebody tells you that they're working on biology, it doesn't necessarily tell you a lot about what they're doing. I went to a systems biology conference last fall, and there were people doing everything from small biological networks to analyzing microarray data, so it could mean almost anything. But broadly speaking, people in systems biology are trying to take the approach opposite to the fundamentalist or reductionist approach, meaning in biology, just like in physics, a caricature of the history would be to say that people started studying whole critters and then studied parts of critters, like just genes, and then started studying individual proteins. And sort of as a reaction to lots of people studying individual proteins, particularly in the late 90s, many people said, well, if we really want to understand the biological phenomena, we can't keep taking the biological materials out of the biology. For example, if you want to understand how do different proteins interact with each other, you really need to understand those proteins in the context of their system, meaning you won't understand the interactions of two different proteins competing with each other by studying one of those two proteins alone. So people started describing this as systems biology. But like I said, you'll get a different answer as to what systems biology means if you ask the Department of Systems Biology at Harvard, or if you ask the Institute of Systems Biology at in Seattle, you'll get very different meanings for what systems biology is. One sort of joke to what systems biology means is the end of one gene, one PhD, meaning it's no longer going to be appropriate to study the system, to study some biological system by isolating one protein, knocking it out, and seeing what it does. You need to understand what you might call the collective phenomena. So those are the sorts of problems I'm going to be looking at, is problems involving many individual units interacting with each other collectively, where somehow the behavior you're interested in is not a property of any of those one objects alone.
I don't know yet.
One what? No, I think it'll be much worse than one equation. It'll be much worse. But you know, I don't make the rules. We'll find out. We'll have to ask the Department of Systems Biology what the new rule is for getting a PhD. By the way, so as an illustration of the kind of little systems that people study in systems biology, probably some of you know what this system is. Does anyone know what this is? Just so I get a context for where my audience is. Lambda phage. Okay, so this is working of a little genetic switch. In fact, there's a book about it called A Genetic Switch, which Phil Nelson recommended I read many, many years ago. lambda phage is a virus, and it goes into bacteria, and it has to decide whether to blow the cell open or to incorporate its genome into the bacterial genome and let the bacterium do the work by dividing. Every time it divides its own genome. And the way this works is by having two different proteins that turn each other off. Depending on the chemical environment or how stressed out the bacterium is, one of these proteins will degrade more quickly, and you'll have sort of balance between two different states, and one of those two states will win. Now then, the working of that system, this sort of switch, cannot be studied by just understanding in detail what this protein is shaped like, nor what this protein is shaped like. If you really want to understand the switch behavior, you want to go about trying to understand both of the proteins at once and how they interact in a context. So that's a simple example of what somebody might mean by systems biology. But again, systems biology is not quite a well-defined discipline yet. Often it involves these sorts of networks. So this is another... Years ago, I gave a talk on biological networks, and somebody in the audience said, well, there's only one biological network, and that's the neuronal network, which is a physical network of different neurons connected to each other. But there are other types of networks that people are studying and trying to understand in biology, which are sort of conceptual networks. Here, you can imagine representing the interaction of these proteins as a small network. This protein binds to a stretch of DNA and turns off the expression of this protein, and then vice versa. So you can think about the genes as two nodes and the edges, meaning that they somehow regulate each other's interaction. Let me make that a little more explicit, since the first half of this talk is about exactly this type of biological network. So a review of biology as learned in high school, depending on when you went to high school, is that there's a linear flow of information, that DNA becomes RNA and RNA becomes protein, meaning that there's a long biopolymer here. Stretches of it are copied into little scripts, transcripts, which are then translated into a totally different language, namely the language of proteins. That's what's going on in that previous slide. There's a stretch of DNA, and then there's a little part of it that's going to get copied. What's interesting is that these proteins that are then made have their job as doing strange things, like, for example, binding to each other. Some of them dimerize. But many of them have as their job to act as control knobs. So many of the proteins in an organism have as their job binding to nucleic acid and turning off or turning on the expression of other genes. So that's one type of regulatory network. The nodes, again, could be thought of as genes or as the proteins, which are the products of these genes. And an edge in between two nodes then means that this thing is somehow regulating the expression of some other gene or itself. So that's the type of network I'll be talking about first, is what's sometimes called a transcriptional regulatory networks. Certain stretches of DNA make proteins. Some of those proteins have as their function to bind to DNA and turn off or turn off other genes. Right? So that's a type of biological network. It's not a real network in the sense of neurons, which are physical and they touch each other. It's an ideational network. And trying to figure out a model, how do you go about learning which things are controlling each other? The traditional way to do this in biology is to knock things out, do lots and lots of work. That has changed somewhat, or at least there's been a promise that might change in the last decade or two, owing to sort of high-throughput biology. So a different flavor of systems biology is not looking at one small system at a time, but just taking all of the data associated with an organism in different conditions. So this is one of the principal culprits in this new statistical way of learning biology. This is a... shot of a gene chip, a DNA microarray. You can see its actual size. And the idea of a DNA microarray is, roughly speaking, to break open the contents of a cell, to flow out all of the mRNA, these red scripts, and then to make a different pixel on this microRNA for all the different genes. Here's a blow-up where you can imagine many different pixels. And each one of these pixels should correspond to one of the different genes. So hopefully, you should be able to study all these different genes moving on and off, turning on and off as a function of perhaps time, or perhaps as a function of some type of perturbation. And then what you would like to do is, armed with lots and lots and lots of data, somehow shove it into some sort of mathematics and out pop 40 years of bench work, meaning this sort of biological network, as understood by real-life biologists, is only learned by doing lots and lots of experiments. And the hope has been, in the last 15 years or so, that if we just had enough data, and we had the appropriate mathematics, somehow we could obviate all that pipetting and just learn biology directly from statistical techniques. So that's what I'm going to talk about in the first half of this talk, is how do you go about learning these networks from data. And in both half of the talks, I'm going to take almost exactly the same statistical approach. So why is this hard? It's hard because you don't really have a microscopic model. You know, you don't have something like an F equals MA where you can just tune for one unknown parameter, like the mass, and you have lots of data, and you just sort of learn that parameter, and that's the end of it. It's a problem statistically because, so we're going to have to make some sort of phenomenological model, and it's not even exactly clear yet where the model should start. It's a problem in the statistical sense in that it's not like an orthodox statistics problem where you know in advance which are the variables that are relevant and you're just going to sample the data well enough that you might try to learn the distribution from which the data are drawn. So we're going to attempt to do a statistical model without doing the orthodox statistical thing of trying to learn the distribution from which data are drawn, because there are so very many genes. There are so many genes that might be relevant that you don't stand a chance of measuring all of them well enough to learn the distribution. It's a problem even for turning it into numbers, because many of the things that you measure are not numbers. You know, like some of the things you measure is light intensity, and that's a real number. Some of the things, though, are strings, like does your gene contain the letters ACGT or Gattaca or CAT? And that sort of information is not of the form of real numbers, and so there's going to be an integration problem, as they say in the business. How do you go about integrating sequence data with real value data like expression data? Okay, so that's a little bit about what systems biology means and one particular problem that I'll be looking at and try to give you a sense of why this is hard, to try to explain why I'll be using some somewhat unorthodox statistical tools for going about trying to learn this. Now, as Robin and I were talking about at lunch, it's very unclear in many of these statistical approaches to what extent is the model that I learn actually good for predicting anything. And so this is a punchline which my co-authors and I have been trying to push for the last couple of years, is that you should probably, or it might be profitable to try to learn the prediction function from the get-go, so that in the end you can test whether or not your model is actually predictive in ways that I'll make more clear. And this is work that I've been doing for several years along with Joachim Freund, Christina Leslie, and students from physics and computer science and other departments. In short, the goal is to pose the problem of learning the network specifically as trying to learn a prediction function. Can you learn a function which, if you knew all the sequence data associated with a given gene, like if you knew the genome of the bug, and if you knew the abundance of certain proteins as a function of time, could you predict the expression of every gene as a function of time? And posing that as the goal, specifically to make a predictive model, will then lead as a byproduct to some sort of picture of the interaction network and other goodies, as I'll make clear. So we'll try to emphasize the predictivity nature of this problem. So this will be different than a lot of the statistical work that you may have seen. For example, in the bad old days of microarrays here in 1998, some of the things that people first did was to say, well, let's take all of this expression data, of which there was much data, and let's try to group the genes into some sort of understandable cluster. So this is a type of data collapse or data reduction. You're armed with the expression values for many different genes, and you simply pair up genes that seem to be expressing the same way. They seem to have similar expression profiles. You do this iteratively, and you build up what's called a hierarchical tree, or a dendrogram, something that looks like a tree here. And this gives you some way of grouping together all the genes. Now, after you have clustered these things into some number of clusters, and it's up to the expert to decide at what point you cut off this clustering process, after you group the genes into clusters, you can try to see, for example, is it the case that many of the genes that are in the same cluster have the same small word or the same sequence element in their promoter region? So as I said in the earlier cartoon, if I think about a stretch of nucleic acid as a part that's going to get copied, and then a part where all the control knobs are, sorry, Adrian, the control knobs, but Adrian already knows this part, the part where the control knobs are has small words which are not going to get copied and made into mRNA, and they're not going to get translated and made into protein. Their only job is for certain proteins to bind there and then to turn off or turn off the expression of those other genes. And so that, if you really wanted to infer the network, one of the things you might focus on is where are the places where the proteins are going to bind, because that is going to be, that is going to constrain what the possible edges are in your network. So like I said, in the bad old days, people did something that you might call cluster first, ask questions later, wherein they clustered all the genes together, and then afterwards they looked to find small words, you know, Gattaca, cat, whatever, that occurred in the promoter region, the control knobs of many of the genes in the same cluster. And in fact, this is so common now that you can buy a MATLAB bioinformatics toolbox where you just upload your data and MATLAB will automatically cluster it for you and then tell you what are the really important things. In the business of statistics, this is sometimes called unsupervised learning, in that you're not trying to learn an input-output relation like expression as a function of sequence. You're just trying to group together all your inputs. So this is not what I will be doing. This is clustering, for those of you who may have seen this before. It's not what's going to be going on in this talk. Instead, oh yeah, this is a screenshot from MathWorks. Oops. I wouldn't know. I assume they hand you a p-value. But I don't know. I've never used it. This is a screenshot, not from my own computer. This is a screenshot from MathWorks. So I haven't used it myself. Right. So those of you who have followed the field know that clustering is something that is now done in a wide variety of problems without issue. So instead, I'm not going to do that. Instead, I'm going to actually try to put prediction to the forefront. I'm going to be interested in trying to learn the prediction function, which is complex enough that I can learn the data that it has, you know, as Robin and I were saying at lunch, you know, many parameters that you can somehow learn. It has the room to be really complex, but it's not too complex because you don't want to overfit your data, meaning you want you want a model that's simple enough that it will work on experiments that you didn't see when you were building the model. And what would be even better is if you have something that's not just a black box, but something that you could open up and actually see how the black box works, something that is interpretable to a biologist. And we will do that by basing this on very biological rules. So I'm going to exploit three tricks in making this work. Or at least when we originally worked on this, we started exploiting three tricks. It's unclear to me how many of these tricks we could do without. But one thing is, it's hard to try to learn all the genes controlling all the different genes. For example, in yeast, which is a very simple bug, but a very well-studied bug, a eukaryote, so it could be worse. I mean, it could be better. It could be even simpler. But in yeast, there's something like 6,000 genes. This number is dropping all the time, but there's something like 6,000 genes, which means if you really wanted to learn all the possible interactions, you've got something like 6,000 squared possible interactions. Now, how many actual experiments do I have? How many data do I have? Well, in a large corpus of microarray experiments, you will be lucky if you get something like 100 microarray experiments, which is like 100 independent snapshots of different genes going on and off as a function of time. So that's an extremely undersampled, ill-posed statistical inference problem. So you can make things easier by pointing out that for most organisms, you have some annotation information. Some of the genes you know don't do anything interesting. I mean, they don't do anything regulatory. They make actin, or they do something that doesn't actually regulate how other genes are going to be behaving. So you can use those genes as targets because, again, all you really need is the promoter region, the control knobs for that gene, to try to figure out which genes are controlling each other. So that's one way to make things better, is to realize that genes don't control genes. Binding sites control genes, and then proteins bind to those binding sites. So stated more explicitly, part of that is to make the network not a bipartite network with genes controlling genes, but a tripartite network where there are certain things that regulate genes that have expression values, certain words like Gattaca or cat or sequence elements that these proteins bind to, and then once you know the sequence of a bug, you know which binding sites are upstream or in the control region of the associated target genes. These binding sites, by the way, are sometimes called motifs because they appear more than you expect. So for example, let's look at an example of a motif. So you look in the promoter region, say 500 base pairs upstream of the part that's going to get copied, and you'll find some long strings that occur much more than you should have expected. Meaning you can assign a p-value to it if you look at the probability that you would see this very, very long string twice in one 500 letter string. Called motifs because you might look for these by looking for things that occur more than you want, or more than you would have expected. What we're interested in doing is finding binding sites or finding magic words, not based on whether or not they occur a lot, but whether or not knowing whether or not you have this magic word in your control region gives you predictive power for predicting how that given gene is going to respond as a function of time. Yes?
When you divide things between the chords, the things on the left side, what do you do to genes that are not annotated? You dump it on the right-hand side?
I think what you should do is allow it to be a putative parent. What we did do is just followed what Aron Segal and Daphne Koller and other people's did, and just said, okay, let's just take their list of signaling molecules and transcription factors and say those are putative parents. So that's what we did. But it's not clear to me that you, for reasons that'll become clear in a few slides, it's not clear to me that you need to do it as restrictively as we did. But what we did is we just said everything that's a signaling molecule or transcription factor, or even a putative transcription factor or a putative signaling molecule, goes in this list of regulators. So these red strings here are the strings that are very, very long and are almost letter for letter exactly the same, right? So if you just pulled letters out of a hat, out of a bag, right, ACGT, ACJT, it would be extremely improbable that you would get some very, very long word that occurs twice, right? And this sort of statistical significance is interpreted by people to mean biological significance. That is, if you're looking at random letters drawn from a bag and you keep seeing cat appear over and over again, right, and cat appears much more than the probability of C times the probability of A times the probability of T, that would be statistical significance in the context of some null model. And people interpret that to mean biological significance. That is how people usually find that is one way that people find binding sites, is you group a bunch of genes into clusters, and then you say, what are the little sequence elements such that they occur so much that that statistical significance could only mean some biological significance? And instead, what we will do is to ask the question, what are the little sequence elements such that if you know whether or not it's there, that gives you for predictive power for predicting how the gene behaves? Okay?
So please. Here
I'm color coding for you three motifs. Just three strings that are known to yeast biologists to be. So these are three different locations in the control. These are three different locations in the promoter regions which you might expect things to bind to. So if this is red, red, and blue, it might be that there's protein of flavor A that binds here and here, and then a protein of flavor B that binds there. That's the interpretation of the fact that you see these words a lot. So the understanding, so the cartoon of the way regulatory networks work that I'm handing you, and that's implicit in this way of modeling, is that there is a stretch of the genome which is responsible for controlling how this thing is going to get copied, how often this thing is going to get copied. And the way that that works is there's an enzyme, a big box, that makes more RNA, and that box is recruited to do that job by other proteins which help that box, or encourage that box to bind here and then start transcribing. Okay? That's like I said, that's biology as told by a theorist. There's much worse than that, but that's the basic level as understood in this model.
I thought there's only one promoter region.
There's one promoter region. Well, I can declare some string for every gene to be that promoter region for that different gene, right? But every gene has a different promoter region. And so this might have red, red, and blue motifs, and this might have green, blue, and red motifs, and something else. Right? Every gene has its own promoter region. But if you see some word that keeps showing up in every promoter region, that word might have biological significance in addition to the statistical significance. Okay, so that's the sort of elements that we'll be looking for in our model, but what is the model actually going to do? So like I said, I'm going to try to build a model explicitly with an eye towards predicting how different genes behave. And the way I'm going to do that is to try to treat the expression as a class label. So I'm going to borrow a tool from machine learning, which is a field growing out of computer science and statistics, for doing things like predicting whether or not a given set of pixels represents a 6 or a 5 or a 4 or a 3. So if you were to try to guess, how would I build a model that can tell 3 from 4? One way to approach it is to say, well, I'll sit down and I'll build a theory of what 3 looks like, You know, three is round and squishy and has a hole on the left, and four is angular and pointy, and one is very, very straight. You could start out by deciding in advance what is going to be the discriminative feature, such that if I hand you some character, the model will output three or four or five. A totally different way of doing it is the way that actually works, which is you take a corpus of many examples of people writing the numbers 3, 4, 5, 6, whatever, and you try to learn from the data what is the combination of, say, this pixel being on, this pixel being off, that gives you a predictive power for predicting whether or not you're seeing 3 or 4. Let me explain this in a little more statistical terms that's easier to visualize. Say that you were trying to tell bananas from oranges. So imagine that you had a friend who was having difficulty with this. You could try to build a statistical model for telling bananas from oranges. Now, what would Gauss do? Gauss would say, well, probably there's a Gaussian centered around the center of the bananas, and probably there's a Gaussian centered around the center of the oranges. That's my prior belief. And so I will simply measure the length and the height of all the different fruit, and I will measure the mean and the covariances of this distribution and the means and the covariances of that distribution. This is a totally reasonable thing to do if you know that it's Gaussian, and if you already know what is it that makes a banana a banana. But if you have to measure everything because you don't know yet what are the actual features that give you discriminative power, then you run into a problem, or sometimes called a curse. You run into the curse of dimensionality, as statisticians have been calling it since the 60s, that when you have many, many relevant features, you won't be able to measure the means and the covariances of all these different distributions, or these two different distributions in this case. And so you're going to have to try to build a classifier or a predictive model without trying to learn the distribution from which the data were drawn. So here, I'm not trying to learn what makes a banana and what makes an orange. I'm trying to learn what sort of prediction function can predict if a gene is going to go down or go up as a function of what sequence elements it has in its promoter region. There's a game theoretic way of phrasing this, which is to assume that you're always going to have bad bananas and pathological oranges. And there's a much more mathematical way of posing it, which is called large deviation theory, which basically says that you should try to find the really bad bananas. You should try to find the really bad pathological oranges. And then you should try to build a separating line that just separates these things very well from each other. And by doing that, rather than trying to learn the distribution from which the data are drawn, you can build a model which performs as well as possible on future data, which generalizes as well as possible for future data. So the tools for doing this have really only matured in the last decade or so. The tools for doing this are variously known as boosting, in a way I'll illustrate in a few seconds, or support vector machines, which is a tool for finding the really bad bananas and finding the really pathological oranges, even in high-dimensional data spaces. I should say a little bit for those of you who may have heard support vector machines and been mystified by the name, as I was. They're called support vector machines. The algorithm is called a support vector machine because the bad bananas live in a vector space, the space defined by all the different features. They support the eventual decision boundary, and machine simply means that there's an algorithm for doing it, so that if you wanted to, you could program a machine to do it for you. You wouldn't have to do it yourself. So as I said, biologists don't care about making things that predict banana versus oranges. What's more interesting is, can you make an algorithm, a model, that can predict if a given gene is going to go up or go down? The network inference part comes because the model that I'm going to build is a model in which the only unknowns are edges that connect regulatory molecules with sequence elements. So the model will only be able to ask questions like, is it that the gene you're trying to predict has this element in its promoter region? And is it the case that this certain transcription factor or signaling molecule was downregulated or upregulated in the experiment you're interested in? And that feature then will be selected if it gives you predictive power for predicting how all the different genes are going to respond. So that's the kind of model I'm going to build. So the unknowns in the model are themselves the edges in the regulatory network. Those are the unknowns in the network you're trying to infer. In terms of data, what this looks like is taking if you imagine this as a cartoon of microarray data and sequence data. Microarray data is, you can think of it as an array, where here on the x-axis I have all the different experiments, or if you like, time, and on the y-axis I have all the different genes. What I wish to do is build a function which can predict if this gene, experiment pair is going to be up or down, and I'm going to integrate gene-specific information, like is this particular binding site or word present or not, with experiment-specific information, like is USB1 or some other famous transcriptional regulator upregulated or downregulated? That is a certain parent or is a certain regulator up or down? And by combining the gene-specific information with the experiment-specific information, I'm going to learn the underlying network. Right? And I'm going to learn the network if and only if I have a function which can predict how every different gene is going to respond at a different time, and I'm going to validate that statistically. Yeah.
There seems to be a premise that the activity of transcription factors can be reduced from
an mRNA level.
Fail for lack of time.
Yeah.
So what fraction of transcription factors behave
Right. Right. So I can only sleep well at night after making this model if I acknowledge that this is a phenomenological model. Right? That mRNA is certainly informative. Okay. I have access only to mRNA abundance.
Perhaps you're better off, but since you cannot, for the transcription factors, for the activity, you cannot infer from on the basis of observing the expression, you may be better off substituting the activity of the children, you may be better off correlating expression of gene X with expression of gene Y, right? In the hope that the transcription factors will often do regulate more than one factor.
Okay, so there's at least...
Which would also become a one.
Okay, so depending on exactly what you're asking, there's at least three different ways I can respond to this. One is that all I have is mRNA abundance data, so I can only use mRNA abundance data to learn from. Another is that if I want to learn activity, for example, what I could try to do is correlate with the mRNA abundance of signaling molecules, right? So if I have mRNA abundance data, which describes how much a certain kinase has been expressed, I could use that as a proxy for regulation.
I'm asking, so how much of a commitment you're making here, since you will have to decide a priori who the parents are, how much of a commitment are you making to transcription factors being parents?
So when you set up the problem, if you include signaling molecules as potential parents, then you gain, because then you can learn these sort of interesting interactions, like maybe it was a kinase.
Maybe I understand what you mean by signaling molecules. What do you think of
signaling? Anything that phosphorylates or dephosphorylates something else, any kinase or phosphatase? Yes.
Which you learn from the expression itself.
Right.
And where you sort of come into RNA variation of a particular set of molecules, it's clear that you do better or you're tying yourself too much. I could have imagined you throw in an additional set of variables that is to be fit.
Yes.
Right, which also impinge on your motives, right? So there are things that are in your data sets and there are things that could be regression parameters.
Yes.
Right, and it's a matter of choice in things like reviews. Those variables totally have to be picked from data.
Yes.
Whereas for your algorithms, you actually have been given mRNA variation data in terms of which you have to express.
Yes.
Right. So question is that are you getting troubled by that or you know?
The model ends up working really well. I don't know how badly the model would work if I didn't include the signaling molecules. That may be an experiment that a student has done over the last 2 years, and I'm just forgetting now the result of that experiment, but the experiment works pretty well and fits without overfitting in ways that I can make more clear. A third way that I could respond to this is you said something about gene X correlating with gene Y. In the end, the model is never allowed to ask which gene it's talking about. The model will only ask about unknown edges. So you never try to directly correlate gene F with gene Q. You only try to...
I think Boris is saying, couldn't there be cases where you want to do that? So suppose you have transcription factor A, and it regulates gene 1 through 10.
Yes.
A transcription factor A, if mRNA is not a good indication of how much protein activity there is.
Yes.
So if you were actually using gene 1 through 10 as parents, you might be able to indirectly know that transcription factor A was active, even though the mRNA level didn't tell you that.
Okay. I see. That is, if I were to allow some of my targets to be parents, I could learn some more structure?
Maybe, yeah.
Potentially, but the problem there... Okay. Right.
So, like have some sort of hidden parent.
Yes.
So your parent is really sort of representative of a regular.
Yes.
Representative of some cluster.
Right. Yeah.
Activity.
Yes.
Of a bunch of genes.
Okay.
And
yes. So
the one that to pop out
yes.
of thin air to parameterize sort of collective behavior
yes.
of clusters on your.
Okay. So,
whereas if I decide that this transcription factor better correlate with something, because I know I kind of need a transcription factor, that could.
Okay. Let me show you some statistical results because your questions will probably change after I show you the actual data.
Okay.
In general, I think you're asking a question about what would happen if I enrich my feature space so that I can make more complicated features. In general, you sometimes fit better, you sometimes overfit your data, but you always give up a little bit on interpretability. The simpler and more sort of obvious your features are, the more interpretable your eventual model is going to be in ways that I'll make more clear. Okay, so as I said, I'm trying to interested in learning which edges in an unknown regulatory network give me predictive power, and I'm going to test this statistically. Just so I have one slide about boosting and also one slide with a little bit of mathematics. As I said, there's a way of doing this which is called support vector machines, which is to find the really bad examples. There's an analogous way to do this which introduces one feature at a time, which is called boosting. Observation, which was not the observation which motivated boosting, but which was pointed out by a number of statisticians after the fact. If I had the following expectation, where I take an expectation over the possible values of the class label, y is the class label, it could be +1 or -1. If I had some unknown function f, and I calculated its expectation, and then tried to minimize that over all possible values of f, the minimizer of that expectation turns out to be 1/2 the log odds, the logarithm of the probability of being up divided by the probability of being down. That observation motivates trying to do this empirically. This expectation looks a lot like the sort of partition function, meaning you sum over all your examples. Your examples come with class labels, +1 or -1, banana or orange, upregulated or downregulated. And then I write down some unknown function which is a linear combination of classifiers, individual functions which produce +1. And for us, the unknowns will be, does there or does there not exist different edges in the regulatory network? I then perform a coordinate descent, which is one particular mathematical approach for minimizing a function, but it's a mathematical approach which adds one rule at a time to the network. So in a way, by doing this learning approach, I'm adding one rule, one edge at a time to the unknown network. And another way of interpreting what this does is you go back and add new rules in a way that maximizes the weight on the things that you got wrong for the previous rule. So I'm going to do this in a way, boosting is a way of building the network one edge at a time that gives you a prediction function which you can then test on data that you didn't see when you're trying to build the network. So that's the class trick. The last trick is to make something that's very interpretable, meaning I want to build a model where I can sort of look at it and see how the model works. And the way I do this is to build a model using a type of decision tree called an alternating decision tree, sort of a quantitative version of decision trees introduced by Freud and Mason in the 90s, which exploits boosting and is a type of large margin, large deviation classifier. But every node, every question in the game of 20 questions is a compound question involving the activity of a certain transcription factor or signaling molecule and the presence or absence of a certain sequence element. So this is basically the model. You get one tree for the whole genome. That is, you get one control logic. This describes all the different genes in an organism for all different experiments and gives you at the end a quantitative version of 20 questions where the number that you get at the end is interpretable as the logarithm of the probability that a gene is going to be upregulated. So you have a very highly interpretable model. Yeah, so boosting is this approach to minimizing this function. So boosting is basically a coordinate descent approach to minimizing this partition function, where the things over which you minimize are the strength of these different unknown classifiers. So you have many, many classifiers, which for me is going to be edges in a network. And I add one edge to the network with a weight, which is given by coordinate descent. So empirically minimizing this partition function is a way of approximating the true minimizer, which would be exactly equal to this log odds. It's a type of classifier, just like support vector machines, except you introduce one unknown at a time, rather than try to find the hyperplane in some high-dimensional space. Please.
Is this a way of getting the most out of the data, or is it a way of simplifying so that you could at least get it close? The first statement is just sort of a lot of something exponential, then just sort of a way of taking average. But it's not clear what you're approximating here. Are you saying I'm going to...
So there's
some property in the data that will allow me to do this, or is it...
There's a true distribution which I don't know,
right,
which is the probability of being a banana given length, width, height, and everything else. I don't know that distribution, but I know that my data were drawn from that distribution.
Right.
So I'm going to empirically approximate that true expectation by empirical expectation over the data. By minimizing this function, by minimizing this partition function, I will attempt to construct a prediction function, f, which includes these unknowns and which should predict how different genes are going to respond in different experiments.
And it's not forcing character on the distribution.
You're forcing a character on the model. So it behooves you to choose the weak rules, as these are called, in a way that will give you an interpretable model. And it behooves you to exploit decades of biological knowledge when you construct these weak rules. So for example, if decades of pipetting have taught the world that the way things regulate each other is by having different transcription factors bind to certain sequence elements, it would behoove you to make these weak rules, the unknown weak rules or individual interactions in the overall compound function, things that are based on exactly that biology. Right? So that's why the weak rules from which you build up the whole control logic are these individual unknown edges in a regulatory network. Okay, so we did this for some published data set. So in 2000, Audrey Gash and co-workers published a data set of 173 different microarrays, that is 173 different snapshots of 6,000 different genes responding to different types of stresses. Following the lead of luminaries in the field, we borrowed the partitioning of the genes into transcription factors, some signaling molecules, and everything else being just a total target. In the original incarnation of this work, we said, let us not try to learn the motifs ab initio, as I'll do in two slides, but let's just take some commercial database that tells us who are these binding sites. So we went to TransFAC, which is a commercial database, the quality of which is often discussed in the community, of the existing motifs, the existing binding sites. And then we took our data, because we wanted to turn this into a class label, and restricted ourselves into only the really most upregulated things, called those bananas, and really the only most downregulated things, and called those oranges, and everything in the middle we remain agnostic about. So this doesn't look like much. It looks like schmutz. But as far as I know, this is the first plot of prediction versus experiment in functional genomics, meaning you take the expression data that you have, you take a subset of the experiments, and you're trying to learn a model. And then you plot the output of that decision tree, that prediction function f, against the actual log of the expression ratio for data that you did not see when you were building the experiment. So if somebody tells you they have a model that reproduces the experiment very well, you shouldn't believe them until they show you a plot like this. You shouldn't believe them until they show you how well does your model do on data that you did not see when you were training the model. So Audrey Gash gives you 173 microarrays. You simply take 90% of those microarrays and use those to train the data, and then you see how badly the model overfits on the unknown data, on the data that you didn't see. So as I said, it's a classification problem, it's not a regression problem, so I'm not trying to make this look like a straight line. What I'm trying to minimize is the number of blue dots that appear out here or out here, times that I predicted a thing would go up and actually it went down, or times that I predicted it would go down and it actually went up. Cross-validation is what statisticians call this. Those are data about which the model remains agnostic. So those are not penalized. So when you write down this empirical loss function, Z, you only sum over the things that are clearly up or clearly down. And you don't penalize things that are sort of in the middle. Now, since I'm adding one edge at a time to the network, please. not gracefully. So the way this was done originally was simply to take the biggest 5% and the smallest 5% of the data. That is, the things that are most overexpressed and the things that are most underexpressed. In later work, we looked at it a little more carefully about red versus green and things like that. So since I'm adding one edge at a time to this network, you should expect that at some point you'll start overfitting the data, which is why we use this boosting approach, which tends to work very, very well, freakishly well, at not overfitting data that you are handed. That is, you add new edges, but the edges that you add later are introduced with smaller, smaller strength, so you can plot how badly the model is doing as a number, as a function of the number of edges in your network. And you can see that for the true data, it does a good job. As you add more edges, your test loss goes down and down and down. But if I scramble some of the data to assign statistical significance to this,
test loss is just an error rate when you do the cross-validation.
Specifically on unseen data. Right. So it's not how badly I'm overfitting the real data. It's how well I generalize to unseen data. So then you might ask, well, am I really learning biology, or am I just learning nearest neighbor classification? So you can try scrambling, say, the expression values for all the parents, or you can try scrambling the sequence data for all the different regulated genes and see how much of the knowledge is really coming from these different types of data. Or you could scramble everything, which is the green line, in which case you should only overfit the data, and sure enough, when you scramble everything, the test loss only goes monotonically up. Now, these guys. So you scramble the expression data for some of the parents, and there's still information in the sequence elements, right? Like if I just knew the genomes of the bugs, then I could compare things that have the same sequence data and still learn something from them. There's more
information. The parents here are
transcription factors and signaling molecules. I think you're learning motifs from just seeing something go through lots of behaviors.
But you're not. About something being up or something being down.
Right. So at some.
If you just randomly pick somebody, it suits the purpose there.
I didn't look under the hood in that detail, but yeah, that's what I'm guessing, is that at some point you're going to get somebody who's up a lot or down a lot and becomes a good proxy for true.
Yeah. So that would be
good proxy for always true.
Those famous activity variables, except that it's a fake thing.
Except now it's fake. Absolutely. So what we realized later is that since this technique works so well in high dimensions, what you could do is just forget about transfac and just say, let's have every 7-mer be a potential motif, every potential binding site, or every dimer be a potential motif, and then simply learn from the data what are the motifs that actually give you predictive power. And to our surprise, or to my surprise, it actually works very well. So the second version of this technique was called Medusa. Medusa is a technique where you ab initio, you just say that every 7-mer and every dimer is a potential regulatory element, and then you simply learn from the data, and then at the end you can look up what Medusa learned, and you can look in your favorite database and see that you actually learn many of the regulatory sequence elements that were known to biologists. And this works. Let me not go through the technical details of how this works, because in the interest of time, except to say that it's in a very high-dimensional feature space. That is, by assigning every possible 7-mer to be and every dimer to be a potential element, you actually have a feature space that is the analog of length, width, and height, and also the analog of the number of unknown edges in the regulatory network, which is something like 10 million. So at every round, it's testing out 10 million possible things that you can add, which is why this program takes several days to run. But in the end, you end up with not only the network, not only a prediction function, but also a list of the regulatory elements. So ab initio, you know nothing about what are the regulatory elements, and you simply learn them from data. What we plot here is that if you start out knowing nothing and you simply learn those elements, you get a very good test loss. If you were to believe somebody else, and instead of trying to learn the regulatory elements from data, you simply believed Linus or believed transfac, you would actually get a worse test loss. You would get a model that performs more poorly. Yes, Julie? Right. So, yes, mostly, with the exception of if you learn something like, if one of the edges that's introduced to your model is something like a transcription factor interacting with a signaling molecule, then clearly you're not talking about a direct binding. In that case, there really is, as Boris was saying before, a hidden node, which is whatever is the unknown transcription factor that you weren't querying, Right, so again, you've made your feature space more complicated, but you have to give up some interpretability. Right, the model has learned that there's some predictive, that it's predictive to know about this sequence element and this other signaling molecule. You know that the signaling molecule isn't binding. Rather, whoever the transcription factor is that's binding to that seems to be interacting with that signaling molecule.
Wait, can you explain that picture again?
Yeah. So if right. So this is some signaling protein which binds to a motif. Well, sorry, in this case it's direct. So in this case the protein is a transcription factor. But here, there's a transcription factor, and then there's some other protein that, say, phosphorylates this transcription factor or does something to change its activity. If you learn, that is, if Medusa chooses an edge, which is an edge connecting the mRNA abundance of a signaling molecule with the presence or absence of a certain sequence element, it gives you predictive power, but you know, I mean, you can't interpret that as a direct binding. Right? The signaling molecule doesn't bind to rather, the signaling molecule changes the activity state of something which then binds to the nucleic acid. So that's an example where you can make your feature space richer at the price that you end up with hidden nodes.
Right? In the case that the transcription factor has not yet been discovered, you would get this signaling protein.
It may be that the transcription factor is not discovered, or rather that the mRNA abundance of that transcription factor isn't as informative, isn't as predictive, as the mRNA abundance of the signaling molecule which acts on it. Okay.
What we do is that in ribosome biosynthesis, there are things like this RRP pack element, and nobody knows what transcription factors they bind to.
Mm.
And it's very interesting to see what signaling pathway molecules, whether they connect up in your, if you look under the hood.
If there's a lot of mRNA microarray data for it, yeah, that might be an interesting experiment.
It's possible because in many stress response, you know, ribosome biosynthesis is whatever it connected to, same signaling pathway, maybe hitting
it. That sounds like a profitable post-processing to look at the model. I wanted to say a little bit about taking an exactly analogous approach to network science, meaning once somebody's handed you a network, or in this case a really big list of things interacting with each other, now what? So another sort of related problem in systems biology that I'll approach using the exact same statistical tool is, when somebody hands you some really big hairball, what are you supposed to measure? I mean, should you be measuring the diameter? Should you be measuring the absorption coefficient? Should you be measuring the degree distribution? How do you decide what is the appropriate way to quantify a given network? And part of the problem that motivated me to look at this was multiple models of how biological networks evolve, meaning for a given network, it sometimes happens that one theorist will get up and theorist A will get up and say, well, the internet is model alpha because it's a statistical property. And then theorist B will get up and say, no, the internet is model beta because it has the following statistical property. So it would be useful to have some sort of predictive approach where the thing that you're predicting is, how did the network actually evolve? And it would be useful not to decide in advance what is the statistic that should be the discriminative statistic. And the appropriate way to do that, I claim, is to treat this as a classification problem in which you are attempting to learn different evolutionary mechanisms by measuring everything there is to measure about the network. You can't give a talk on networks without saying the words Erdos scale-free small world, so let me just say how what I'm doing does and does not relate to any of that. For those of you who may have heard any of these words, scale-free, which is a word that often is said in the same time as anybody says the word network, is an attribute, a statistical attribute of a given network, meaning that I can look at some particular distribution, like the probability that a node is connected to k other things, and if that function follows a particular shape, I will declare it to be scale-free. That observation, a statistical observation, then motivated a particular model of how a network evolves, which is sometimes called the preferential attachment model. Similarly, around the same time, people noticed that certain synthetic networks could be made that were very small, meaning they have much smaller diameter than you would expect based on some of their statistical arguments. And that statistical observation then motivated a model of how networks might be created. So there's a small world statistical observation, and then there's a small world model of how networks might be created. Each of these sort of lines of research says that you should measure one particular attribute. Let's take a look at some of those attributes. The problem is that it's possible to grow many examples of different networks which grow by very different evolutionary mechanisms, that have exactly the same, or statistically indistinguishable to the eye, degree distributions. So for example, here in this picture, a student working with me grew 10 examples of networks created by duplication mutation, and then 10 networks created by what's called randomly grown Erdős networks, where I throw down new nodes and then connect them at random. And they're very different sorts of designs, different types of evolutionary designs, but they give rise to the same degree distribution. So essentially, we did the same approach to networks that we did to learning genetic networks, that is, learning evolution in the same way that we went about learning expression. To take a really big hairball like this, like a given biological network, and try to embed it in some space by quantifying lots of different potentially relevant features, and then now treating this as a multi-class classification problem where every class corresponds to a different way that a network could have evolved. So for example, you might want to generate lots of examples of randomly grown Erdős graphs, and lots of examples of preferential attachment graphs, and lots of examples of networks evolving by duplication mutation, and then try to learn what are the features that tell class A from class B, or evolutionary design A from class B from evolutionary design B, and then take your real network, put it in the classifier, and see who wins. So instead of trying to learn bananas and oranges, or instead of trying to learn up and down regulation, here I'm trying to learn something like, was the network created by evolutionary design principle A or evolutionary design principle B? And I will quantify everything there is to measure about these networks and let the data decide what turns out to be the discriminative combination of statistics. Note that the features that you learn are the features that are predictive. This has nothing to do with some particular attribute of the graph being overrepresented relative to some hypothesized null model. If boosting picks out a particular feature of the network, it's because it gives you predictive power, not because there was a null model to which I'm comparing that feature.
One type of network profile for all time, right?
Yes. Well, I mean, you could
for a billion years and then switch.
Right. So you could make new classes.
Yeah.
You could have 20 classes or 60 classes, and what would be bad is that you would start to overfit your data, and that would be manifest in bad test loss. Right? So you're absolutely right that you could make things worse, but then you should generate more training data, and you should be honest about what your test loss is. So I'm going to show you some test loss plots in a minute to show you that we're doing well with this number of classes that we chose. How do you represent a network? What do you measure? Well, we did a few different things. We did subgraph census. Subgraph census is something people have been doing in the social sciences and in discrete mathematics for decades. So we went through and just counted the number of times you saw different subgraphs in different biological networks. Here's a chart of 181 of them. Just to make sure that our result didn't depend on... Yeah, just these are just lots of different subgraphs. What you can't see because of the resolution is one of those charts is something like this, and another chart is something like this. Each one is a different little subgraph, right? And you might just think that you should just count how many times you different subgraph. Yeah.
Your favorite subgraphs?
No. I wanted my favorites to play as little a part of this as possible. So we just make some cutoffs based on the patience of the graduate student. Like, you keep walking down the graphs and only count subgraphs that involve, say, 7 nodes or 8 walks or something like that. Some exhaustive technique for measuring things, right? And this is a particular choice which includes degree distribution, because the degree distribution, say, now you know, if I know how many times this subgraph happens, I know how many things there are of degree 3 or less. And similarly, if I have this little guy, little person, then I know how many things are degree 4 or less. But just to make sure that our result didn't depend on that, we also used an embedding space based on a particular way of representing the graph in terms of a table. If I just make a table that represents this little subgraph, I'll put a 1 if gene 2 points to gene 1, a 1 here if gene 3 points to gene 1, et cetera, et cetera. This table has meaning as a matrix, because if I then say, look at the transpose of the matrix left multiplied by the square of the matrix, and then look at the diagonal component of the resulting matrix, this gives me an instant way of counting which nodes have grandparents that are also their parents, or something like that. If I walk up the graph and then walk down the graph twice and come back to the same place, then I have found this little tiny subgraph. So similarly, you should do something exhaustive rather than deciding in advance what's the interesting feature. So if armed with this little alphabet of letters walking up the graph, down the graph, closed walks, open walks, you can build up an exhaustive set of words of as long a length as your graduate student has patience. In this case, we made some alphabet which includes something like words like the sum of the diagonal components of A squared times the transpose A's, which immediately gives you something like counting the number of times you see some subgraph in the given network. And we did this for something like 4,000 features. So again, we treated this as a multi-class classification problem. The classifier itself is built in, say, 4,000 dimensions. This is just a three-dimensional shadow of what goes on in this classifier. You take many different examples of networks grown by these different evolutionary mechanisms. You build classifiers that can tell bananas from oranges, or in this case, tell preferential attachment from duplication mutation. And then you take a network of interest, say, the transcriptional regulatory network of E. coli, and you put it in the classifier to see who wins. In this particular example,
Yeah. Do you actually look at some differences between your genes or proteins?
No.
So duplication.
So for example, in this case, a computer scientist named Kumar in the early days said, maybe the internet or maybe the World Wide Web grew because people copied each other's web pages and then made links to random other nodes and then deleted a few links. Right? And stating that evolutionary mechanism can be interpreted as an algorithm. So when I tell you things evolve by nodes are duplicated, existing nodes are duplicated, and then with some probability I delete a few nodes.
No, but then there's also, I can look at whatever nodes or web pages, compare them and decide that these two look awfully alike.
Yes.
And likely to be recent duplicates.
So rather than doing that, what we've done is quantify all these different attributes of the resulting networks to try to learn what tells these two topologies apart from each other. Right, so we just simply...
Or you can say that you don't really look at the content of the web page,
right,
but you just look at links.
Yes,
so
I'm interpreting...
Nodes have identical links, therefore, so is that your measure of similarity? That's the measure of...
So I don't actually do a similarity measure, rather I build a classifier by quantifying all these different attributes. But the networks on which the classifier is trained are fully synthetic, right? You build the classifier based on synthetic networks and then take your real network and see which of these evolutionary designs is the best descriptor, right?
Okay, so the duplication here, in the sense that if I understand correctly, as an algorithm for growing the network, you just take the node, duplicate it, which is to say that you link it to all the same...
You make a twin, which is linked to... Yep. Right. And I could copy the outgoing edges or the ingoing edges or both, depending on how I believe that that particular biological network evolved. And in fact, in this case, we tried both. So you can actually tell whether or not it was a network where you duplicated the children or a network in which you duplicated the parents and the children, the ingoing and the outgoing links, which is like saying you're duplicating which genes are regulated by a protein as opposed to whether or not they have the same promoter region. Yeah.
Why do you say Kumar C wins?
So this is by eye. The actual math is done the same way that the math is done before. I build
eye. It looks like Kumar PC wins.
Yeah. So these are duplication mutation mechanisms. The top two are duplication mutation mechanisms, where you either duplicate the things that you point to, or the things that point to you, or both. Right. So this picture is only an R project. The actual classifier actually happens in the same way it does before. We build a quantitative version of 20 questions, and then the network that has the highest score wins. Right?
So the picture
in... No. The picture is just to illustrate. Right? The classification actually happens based on a quantitative decision tree, right, which spits out a certain number. That number tells you which actual evolutionary design principle is most consistent with the network. So when you actually classify, you have something like a real number, which can be interpreted as something like the logarithm of the probability that that evolutionary design created the real biological network. So here on the y-axis, I have a set of numbers, one number for every evolutionary design principle, duplication, mutation with complementarity, which is a mechanism put forward by a theoretical biologist for how biological networks might evolve. duplication mutation without the complementarity, randomly grown air dose graphs, linear preferential attachment, small world graphs, air dose graphs, et cetera, et cetera. It's who wins, who gets the biggest value of this number, the prediction score, which is classified as the true evolutionary design principle. So we did that.
So my question was about, and this isn't for you, but the test one or test
right.
Whatever.
Right.
What are those? So what is this? What information does it have?
Right. So for this particular example, it's the abundance in subgraphs. And because it's a tree, you end up with things that are conditionally important, like if you can count, if you know how many triangles you have, that gives you discriminative power for telling, I don't know, preferential attachment versus small world or something. But also, if you know how many triangles you have, then it is useful, that is predictive, if you also know how many long strings there are, which is like saying that you should measure the clustering coefficient first and then measure the diameter. If you know how many long strings there are, which is like a measurement of the diameter, then it is useful to know how many 5 hubs there are, which is like saying that you should know something about the degree distribution after you've queried the diameter, right? But the idea is to learn from the data what the discriminative statistics are rather than to decide in advance and then try to get a model that tunes to that one particular statistic. I promised Meredith test loss, so we made a plot of the confusion. If I leave out, that is, if I train on some data and then generate new data and see how badly I did, you get very little confusion between the models, with the exception of these two different models, which are actually parametric limits of each other. So in the early days, somebody said, well, let's have linear preferential attachment as one model of how every network was created, which means that new nodes attach to old nodes with a probability proportional to how many nodes that the target node is already connected to. Somebody pointed out, well, on the internet you have things like Yahoo or Google that are very big hubs but were created more recently. And so then the authors made a new model called Active Growing Vertex, but for one parametric limit of active growing vertices, you actually recover the linear preferential attachment, so it's reasonable that they get conflated by the classifier. Everything else does a very good job meaning bad test loss. And so that's how you quantify how many classes you should be allowed to have. The other thing that you shouldn't believe is the network data itself. So these networks are inferred by statistical techniques, which should only be believed, you know, to some amount of fuzz. So for example, we took the protein-protein interaction network for Drosophila melanogaster. So in late 2003, a group published an extensive study by yeast-2 hybrid of all the different protein-protein interactions for this particular bug, the fly. And we built a classifier that could tell these different evolutionary designs apart, in there and just plotted the prediction scores. Now, you might ask, how robust is that ranking to small errors in the network? So what we did was we took the real network, and then at random we just chose any edge in the network, pulled it out, and put it in somewhere at random in the network. So we started introducing errors in the network, and you can see that up to about 30% rewiring of the entire network, you get no change in the classification scores. You get the same ranking of what's the best design. What's reassuring here is that if you rewire more than 80% of the edges, you know what evolutionary design created that network. By definition, it's an Erdős graph, and so it's reassuring to see that after you rewire more than 80% of the edges, you correctly classify the graph as being completely random. There's some other work that we're doing now with yeast protein-protein interaction networks with similar results, but I've run over an hour, so why don't I close so we all have time to get coffee before Rob's colloquium. The punchline basically is instead of deciding what statistic you want to recover, instead to let the data decide what are the predictive features. To illustrate, we did the same approach. We took these 10 examples of duplication mutation with randomness and randomly grown Erdős, built classifiers based on other examples of the same mechanisms which could tell them apart, and then plotted the prediction score. And again, this is how you know who wins, is by a real valued prediction score, and then plotted who wins for those two things, and you see that they're perfectly separable, even if to the eye they're indistinguishable based on degree distributions. So let me, in view of time, not close with lots of deep thoughts about systems biology and high-dimensional statistics and how they're related to each other, but instead thank you for inviting me to talk.
Going to get out from
learning your algorithm, what those classifiers are, if you can look back and see what are the characteristics of the data.
So if you use this particular approach, the decision tree, you end up with a pretty interpretable classifier, right? At the top of the tree, there are a certain set of features which are really discriminative. Depending on whether this is a greater than or a less than, you know if you should have a lot of them or a little of them. And by building trees, you have conditional importance. So you know that it's interesting to know if you have this thing only if... So these are different subgraphs. So for example, if you look at the top row, I've colored the subgraphs in the top row red and in the bottom row blue and drawn an arrow to things that are below each other in the tree. So it's useful to know how many triangles you have, and it's useful to know how many long chains you have, which is like saying that you're measuring the clustering coefficient and the diameter. If you've measured the clustering coefficient, then it's useful to know the diameter. And if you've measured the diameter, then it's useful to know how many high degree nodes there are, right? Because again, this subgraph really tells you how many nodes there are of degree 5 or less. Right? So that gives you a classifier which is somewhat interpretable. So the way it actually comes from in the boosting algorithm is to look at this sort of empirical partition function, as I said earlier. I should probably not slide back, but instead just choose to slide directly. But you construct this thing that looks like a partition function. I'll call it that. It's a loss function. And you add one new rule to the classifier at every round.
This is how you take your information.
Right.
Choosing which rules you're going to put together. So you actually made those subgraphs by hand?
Right. So I just wrote out, or my student wrote algorithms to generate many examples of mechanism A, mechanism F. And then for every example, you quantify how many times you observe this different subgraph, or what is the particular value of this particular functionals of the adjacency matrix, depending on what sort of input space you use. The real data show up in the X's and the Y's. Mm-hmm. Right? You're trying to learn Y's as opposed to that.
A subgraphs is some sort of complete set of possible subgraphs that you already know what they are.
Well, so I've.
Well, that's kind of where the important choice of what the model's going to be goes.
So there, any a priori information you have comes in. Which subgraphs you decide to train your model on.
I try to use as little prior information as possible, except where I'm going to choose the cutoff for possible features. So we did this in a couple of different contexts, like we used different functionals of the adjacency matrix, where we just cut off its 4,000 dimensions, which is equivalently something like words of length 7 letters. We also did cutoffs based on all subgraphs with up to 7 edges, all subgraphs with up to length 8 steps in them. Right. So we tried different input spaces to make sure that we were getting the same results.
The thing what's important is that since you're just trying to discriminate between finites and models, it's important what you're trying to discriminate from. So how does one arrive at this set of 7 models?
So we just went to the literature and took 7 models that seemed to be oft discussed. I mean, I you can rewrite the code.
Is models of internet and random.
So in the beginning, we took different models depending on whether we were classifying a directed or an undirected graph. And I think for directed graphs, we had something like 7 models. And for undirected graphs, we had something like 10 models. And really, we just took them from the literature. Some of them were models of just abstract networks. Some of them were models which claimed to describe the World Wide Web. Some were models purported to describe biological networks. And in one or two cases, they were models purported to describe every network ever. Right. So those were models that we thought would be interesting to start out with. Right. But
when you give a set of data, you know that it's a protein data as opposed to internet data. So you don't have to blindly distinguish between them.
So what was the beginning of your question again? You don't understand what is the purpose?
Why would you try to fit protein data with an internet model?
You would be surprised. So I would not claim that these models should have purported protein data. Nonetheless, there are cases in the literature where somebody will say, this model describes everything, or this model describes protein and the World Wide Web.
Well, so there is one thing that's not like a microscopic model of the internet. Like all of these are really just models for the way a network could grow.
That's absolutely right.
The way that nodes and edges get added.
Yes.
And so in that sense, why not try it on whatever network you have? If you think it grew from something smaller, there must be some way that happened.
Right. I mean, these are sort of just design principles in the abstract. You know, they don't necessarily say... I mean, although Kumar, for example, wrote down a model trying to describe the World Wide Web, the elements of the model are simply duplication of either the ingoing or the outgoing nodes, and mutation.
That's exactly what I'm trying to, I'm not just criticizing, I'm just trying to understand. So, and my hang up is I have no idea what Kumar C and Kumar PC is, and
sure.
How they differ from duplication. Probably any biologist will be very happy with the conclusion that biological networks grow by duplication and mutation.
Rather than preferential attachment.
So the question is, can one... now it sounds like some of those other models also grow more or less by duplication and mutation, but they're different in some more subtle way. So perhaps what you can distinguish is... the kind of duplication.
Yes, exactly.
And duplication. I'm going to ask a simple question. So, just looking at the topology of the network.
Yes.
Perhaps you can identify your candidate duplicate nodes.
Yeah. Yes. Yes. This line.
In the protein data, yes. It's actually non-trivial. So now there are two ways in which one can identify this duplicate. One is by from two hybrid assays, but they all bind to the same stuff.
Same stuff. Yeah.
And then you apply your network criteria and identify candidate duplicates.
But
then you can actually go to genetic sequence.
Yes.
And see how often it's not actually obvious to me that if you do this with different MAP kinases, which are probably duplicates,
yes.
Right, there's a whole business of duplication and specificity that duplicates, but then it was supposed to get a divorce and never talk to each other again,
yes.
Right? So my simple question is, does network topology actually correspond to sequence similarity?
That's a great question. I haven't done it. I mean, the point of this is to motivate exactly that kind of thing, right? The fact is that you can tell just from the topology, not only that it was duplication mutation and not preferential attachment, but which of, say, competing flavors of duplication mutation is actually selected. So here there was duplication where you duplicate ingoing and outgoing links, and duplication where you just duplicated outgoing links, or whatever, and you can actually tell them apart. Here, for example, there's two different flavors of duplication mutation with complementarity, duplication mutation without that complementarity, and you can actually tell them apart from each other. Now then, for a specific network that you actually care about, I agree with you. You should go try to come up with some sequence similarity measure that you believe in. I'm not a sequence similarity guy, so I don't do a lot of, I don't have any expertise in whether or not I should believe this particular sequence similarity measure over the other. But absolutely, if you believe that there is a if there's a particular network you like, it would be a great line of research then to go and look for evidence of duplication mutation with complementarity rather than not. Or if you're an internet person, or if you're a social network person, I absolutely agree with you that these sorts of tests should motivate you to start looking more seriously at one of the different networks that people have, different evolutionary designs that people have talked about, right? But the goal is to build something where I don't decide in advance what's going to be the important feature, and then to let domain people who do care about a particular network figure out which of the theorists and which of the evolutionary designs should they be listening to. Julie?
So for the different kinds of networks you talked about, some of them have the property that the edges have a direction.
Yes.
And some of them don't have that property, like
yes.
The 14-14 interaction network.
Yes, it's totally symmetric.
Yeah.
Yes.
How do you deal with those differences in information?
So what we did, what I think was the honest thing, which is only to compare directed models with directed networks. But of course, if somebody gives you a directed network, you could just ignore the directionality of the edges and just treat it as a symmetric graph. But that's why there's this plethora of different models, is because some of these models are for directed networks and some of them are not, right? Like, there is no meaning to duplicating only the parents or only the children if all the edges have no direction. in this particular case, it was a protein-protein network, so we only looked at models that had no directionality associated with them. But for any directed graph, you can treat it as an undirected graph just by being willing to give up on that information.
How strongly does that affect your predictive capacity?
I haven't tested that. Yeah.
This is very interesting. So, the different question is to how much you need to understand about the experiments, how reliable they are, the details. Because there are good data and there are bad data. So.
Yeah. You mean for network topology, that sort of thing?
So, you know, it's kind of VA library data or, you know, this hybrid, you know, data and so on.
Well, there are some
better than others and so on. So when you do the analysis, you know, how do you decide on, you know, which data set you want to put more weight on and so on? Is it also based on some unbiased optimization, or do you trust one lab more than the other, or, you know,
I have.
Do you trust data set that are more highly cited, or I'm just curious.
So I have never done anything that directly combines different data sets. Other people, for example, Olga Troyanska at Princeton, Mark Gristine, other people, make networks which are actually combinations of different data sets, right? Like this one is a yeast protein-protein network that's actually learned from multiple data sets working together. As a theorist, you know, I want to work with any data that are given to me, so I would like data sets that are openly available and big. Right, so like Audrey Gash's data set is a data set that anybody can download. As far as whether or not it works, well, it works if you get low test loss. It works if you've actually learned some structure from the data and you know that you're not overfitting, and you know that your model is not overfitting the data that are on hand. Right, if the data are purely random, then you should get very high test loss. But the data sets that I worked with are just the ones that are big and openly available to me as a theorist.
Well, I think, you know, you want to have some, you know, right. Want to have some confidence in the data set.
Yes.
So if you understand the details better, then you may have a better way of judging whether this is data set they want to use or not. Because I guess in our field there's a lot of good data and a lot of, you know, bad data and
not good data.
Some theoretical works and that, you know, initiated by, you know, the data set that turned out to be wrong or artifact. And so I guess.
Yeah. I don't have the luxury of choosing from among many data sets. The best I can do is see how badly my results suffer if I introduce errors into the data. And I've chosen one mechanism for introducing errors into the data, and it's a particular mechanism where I know the result for 100% error. But there are other mechanisms for introducing error. For example, if you believe yeast 2 hybrid data or chip data suffers from one particular flavor of error, you have an error model. It would be interesting to take these data and start subjecting those data to that error model. Or you might include, in addition to these classes, a new set of classes, which is the shadow of any linear preferential attachment graph as filtered through some particular error model. I think that would be a very interesting line of work for if you have a particular experimental assay that you like or a particular network that you have serious, strong feelings for. Haven't done that yet. It's a line of research that I hope to do. But I think the best I can do as a theorist is take whatever data anybody's willing to give me and start messing with it to try to see how badly my results suffer if there really are experimental errors.
Maybe we should thank Chris and continue.
Yeah. Okay. Thanks, Chris.